Welcome to NTD News Today. Here are today's top stories. Global markets rise today as President Trump suggests easing some car tariffs temporarily. It's tax day today. Still haven't filed the tips on how to get an extension and more. The Trump administration freezes more than $2 billion in funding to Harvard University. What the Ivy League school says about academic freedom. Federal judges work against the Trump administration on immigration, with over 530,000 migrants protected by a new ruling. Officials attempt to determine the motive behind the arson at the Pennsylvania governor's mansion. A 38-year-old man faces attempted murder and terrorism charges. Iran-backed Houthi terrorists say the U.S. attacked them late last night, killing seven people. This as the U.S. is preparing for a second round of nuclear talks with the Iranian regime.
This is NTD News Today, live from our global headquarters in New York City.
Today is Tuesday, April 15th. I'm Stephanie Eckox. Global markets mostly rose today, echoing a rally on Wall Street. The uptick comes after President Trump appeared to let up on some of his tariffs. Trump said he was considering a change to the 25% tariff imposed on foreign auto and auto parts imports from Mexico, Canada, and other countries.
I'm looking at something to help some of the car companies where they're switching to parts that were made in Canada, Mexico, and other places. And they need a little bit of time because they're going to make them here. But they need a little bit of time. So I'm talking about things like that.
Stock indexes in Germany, France, Spain, and the UK were all up today. The auto and parts index climbed over 2%, leading gains among sectors. And in Asian trading, Japan's benchmark Nikkei 225 surged nearly 1%. Automakers were among the biggest gainers there, too. Toyota jumped nearly 4%, while Honda gained over 3.5%. Meanwhile, electronics and entertainment giant Sony's stock price added more than 2%. And Wall Street's main indexes also edged up at the open as investors addressed the possibility of tariff relief for the auto sector. The Dow Jones rose 3 points, or 0.01%, and the S&P 500 rose 6 points, while the Nasdaq Composite rose 10.9 points, all at the opening bell. The indexes soon ticked higher after Bank of America, Citigroup, and other banking giants posted strong profits for the first quarter. And the Trump administration is examining the national security implications of importing semiconductors and pharmaceutical products. The Commerce Department said the probes were initiated under Section 232 of the Trade Expansion Act. The legislation allows the president to impose tariffs on imports considered a threat to national security. According to the department, these include semiconductors, legacy chips, leading-edge chips, and microelectronics. Another probe will look at pharmaceuticals imports and their ingredients. The department will also assess the economic impact of, quote, unfair trade practices and state-sponsored overproduction. The announcement follows President Trump's move to exempt smartphones, computers, servers, laptops, tablets, and other electronics from reciprocal tariffs. If you haven't finished your 2024 taxes, the clock is ticking. It's April 15th, otherwise known as Tax Day, the deadline to get federal tax income returns sent to the Internal Revenue Service. While a majority of U.S. taxpayers have already taken care of matters with the tax man, roughly 101 million have yet to do so. There are some exceptions. Businesses and residents in seven disaster-stricken states have been given exemptions. Taxpayers are advised to file electronically if possible. The Taxpayer Advocate Service says that's usually safer and faster than dropping it in the mail. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent said yesterday the White House will start interviewing candidates this fall to succeed Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell. Powell's term ends in May 2026. Bessent says that would give the Trump administration about 6 months lead time before Powell leaves office. He gave no further details. President Trump has pressed the Fed repeatedly to lower interest rates, accusing Powell of playing politics. Bessent said he was not concerned about Trump ousting Powell or challenging the independence of the Fed, but he said he did see room for more discussion on the Fed's role as a bank regulator. Japan's chief negotiator on U.S. tariffs is expected to leave for Washington this week. He'll meet with Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent and Trade Representative Jamison Greer. President Trump initially said he was imposing a 24% reciprocal tariff on Japan. A 90-day pause was announced after that. A 10% universal rate remains in place. Meanwhile, South Korea said today that Seoul will try to delay reciprocal tariffs against the U.S. as much as possible. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent has said the U.S. would sit down with South Korea to discuss the tariffs. Asia's fourth largest economy was hit with 25% reciprocal U.S. tariffs, which have since been paused. South Korea's trade and industry minister may travel to Washington next week for further talks, and we'll keep you updated on all of that. Next, Argentina's president, Javier Milei, says that he understands reciprocal tariffs imposed by President Trump and that he's ready to sign a trade agreement that benefits both countries. Milei made his remarks yesterday in Buenos Aires.
At the commercial level, we understand the proposals of reciprocal tariffs that President Trump has worked on, and we are ready to sign a trade agreement along these lines, which will undoubtedly benefit the U.S. as well as Argentina.
The U.S. is pulling out of a tomato trade agreement with Mexico, saying it no longer protects American growers. The Commerce Department announced yesterday that from July 14th, most Mexican tomatoes imported into the U.S. will face duties of nearly 21%. Officials say the move aims to give American farmers a fair shot in the market. Back in 2019, Mexican producers reached a deal with the Trump administration to avoid an anti-dumping investigation and resolve a tariff dispute. At the time, the United States said the agreement closed loopholes and included an inspection system. The Trump administration has frozen more than $2 billion in funding for Harvard University over its refusal to implement policy changes. Harvard accuses the administration of trying to curtail academic freedom. More on that story now.
The federal government announced Monday it was freezing $2.2 billion in grants and $60 million in contracts to Harvard University. This comes after the Ivy League school said it would reject the government's demands for policy changes. Harvard's president, Alan Garber, wrote Monday the university will not surrender its independence or relinquish its constitutional rights. The Department of Education's Task Force to Combat Anti-Semitism then released a statement announcing the funding freeze. The task force said Harvard's refusal to comply shows a mindset, quote, that federal investment does not come with the responsibility to uphold civil rights laws. Some of the demands the government made to Harvard and several other prestigious schools include eliminating DEI programs, banning masks at campus protests, and limiting the power held by some faculty members. It also mandates that admissions and hiring processes prioritize merit over race and gender-based criteria. In a letter last week, the Trump administration told Harvard to screen out international applicants deemed, quote, hostile to American values or supportive of terrorism. It also demanded an audit of programs at the school's Center for Middle Eastern Studies to root out any faculty who, quote, discriminated against Jewish or Israeli students or incited students to violate Harvard's rules. Garber's response was that no government should dictate what private universities can teach, who they can admit or hire, and which areas of study and inquiry they can pursue. He said Harvard already made extensive reforms to address anti-Semitism. As early as Friday, the Harvard chapter of the American Association of University Professors filed a lawsuit to block the government from cutting funding, saying a freeze was imminent. Last month, Columbia University received a similar list of demands with nearly $5 billion in funding on the line. Unlike Harvard, it agreed to nearly every demand, though the funds remain frozen at this time.
In a Truth Social post today, Trump wrote that Harvard could lose its tax-exempt status and be taxed as a political entity. He said that's if the school keeps pushing what he called political, ideological, and terrorist-inspired content. And next, El Salvador's president tells President Trump that he has to help liberate America from crime and terrorism. We break down their Oval Office meeting. And officials attempt to determine the motive behind the arson at Pennsylvania governor's mansion. A 38-year-old man faces attempted murder and terrorism charges. Disgraced Hollywood mogul Harvey Weinstein is set for a retrial of his sex crimes convictions. But a few things have changed since his 2020 conviction. More on all of that right after this break. Another high-profile deportation case is making headlines. A federal judge in Vermont yesterday blocked the removal of a Columbia University student and pro-Palestinian activist. NTD's Daniel Monahan has more on that and two other immigration cases.
Video captured Mohsen Madawi in handcuffs as federal agents escorted him from a building and placed him in a vehicle. District Judge William Sessions ordered that Madawi not be deported or moved out of Vermont. The Palestinian student, originally from the West Bank, was detained after arriving for a citizenship petition interview. A court filing says Madawi co-founded the Palestinian Student Union at Columbia following the October 7th Hamas terror attacks. Another co-founder, Mahmoud Khalil, was also detained by immigration officials earlier this year. The document states that Madawi was involved in organizing campus protests until stepping down in March. It also says he is a U.S. lawful permanent resident. Senator Bernie Sanders called the detention immoral, inhumane, and illegal, urging Madawi's immediate release and due process. Turning to another immigration case, a federal judge may order the return of Tufts University student Rumeysa Ozturk to Vermont. The 30-year-old Turkish national and doctoral student was detained in Massachusetts in March after her student visa was revoked. She was transferred through several states and is currently being held in Louisiana. Judge Sessions says Ozturk's presence in the Vermont court would be necessary because the court would be addressing issues about release. The judge says she would be able to assist her attorneys with her case. Ozturk argues she was unconstitutionally targeted for deportation in retaliation for a pro-Palestinian op-ed she co-authored in the Tufts student newspaper. And a federal judge issued a setback to President Trump's immigration policy Monday. District Judge Indira Talwani ruled the administration cannot end deportation protections for certain Cuban, Haitian, Nicaraguan, and Venezuelan migrants. Those migrants are in the U.S. under a humanitarian relief program known as CHNV Parole. The Biden administration launched the CHNV program in 2023. It argued CHNV would ease pressure at the southern border by offering a legal, vettable pathway for migrants amid rising numbers. The program was later paused due to widespread fraud, with some recipients arrested for serious crimes, including child rape. It allowed migrants with American sponsors and their immediate families to fly to the U.S. and stay for 2 years under temporary parole. In March, over 530,000 CHNV participants were ordered to leave the U.S. before their parole and work permits expire on April 24th, 1 month after the March 25th notice. Daniel Monahan, NTD News.
The motive of this suspected arsonist who set fire to the Pennsylvania governor's mansion remains unclear. The blaze forced Governor Josh Shapiro's family and friends to evacuate the residence over the weekend. Investigators are digging into Cody Ballmer's background. The 38-year-old Harrisburg resident was denied bail yesterday. He faced charges including attempted murder, terrorism, and arson. Ballmer told police he planned to beat Shapiro with a small sledgehammer if he encountered him after breaking into the home. Ballmer's mother says she called the police in recent days about his mental health issues. She said nobody would help and added that her son was not taking his medication. However, in court, Ballmer told a judge he did not suffer from any mental illness. A man is facing a federal charge after allegedly threatening to kill Director of National Intelligence Tulsi Gabbard and her husband. The Justice Department now released some of the threatening texts the suspect allegedly sent. Ali Akbar Muhammad Ayman of the state of Georgia is charged with transmitting interstate threats. The Justice Department released a statement with the charges yesterday. The statement shows that the suspect sent texts claiming that Gabbard is, quote, living on borrowed time. He allegedly also said Gabbard and her family are going to die soon. The statement also includes that the suspect said things such as death to America and that America will burn. Gabbard thanked the FBI when the arrest was first announced on Friday. She called the suspect a radicalized and dangerous criminal. Investigators have located a critical piece of evidence from the fatal Hudson River helicopter crash. Six people were killed when the helicopter crashed last week. The National Transportation Safety Board says it recovered the chopper's main rotor and roof structure. With that, the NTSB says the recovery effort is now complete. In a statement yesterday, the agency said finding these key components will greatly aid the investigation. Meanwhile, the FAA grounded the helicopter company involved in the crash, citing safety concerns. A letter from the FAA's chief counsel says the company fired an employee who had voluntarily agreed to stop flights. The letter says Director of Operations Jason Costello agreed to halt operations until the investigation was complete. But just minutes later, the company's CEO told the FAA that Costello didn't have that authority and that he was no longer with the company. The FAA said it suspected the firing was in retaliation for a safety-based decision. Disgraced Hollywood mogul Harvey Weinstein is back in the midst of legal drama. A retrial for his alleged sex crime starts today. It's the same New York courthouse that convicted him of sexual assault in a previous trial. That 2020 conviction was overturned after New York's high court ruled that the judge allowed testimony from women not involved in the case. Weinstein's attorneys have expressed hope that a different political climate could lead to a different outcome for the retrial. The judge has granted a request to no longer refer to alleged victims in the case as survivors. They will instead be called complaining witnesses. The judge also granted a request from the Manhattan District Attorney's Office to include a rape expert as a witness in the case. 73-year-old Weinstein has sued New York City over jail conditions. He has pleaded not guilty to the charges. The Department of Transportation says it will save taxpayers more than $60 million by ending a high-speed rail contract in Texas. Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy announced yesterday the agreement between the Federal Railroad Administration and Amtrak had been terminated. The project was initially announced as a private venture, but became increasingly dependent on federal funding as cost estimates increased. Duffy said on X, both the FRA and Amtrak are in agreement that the Texas Central Railway project is a waste of taxpayer funds. Meanwhile, the Department of Government Efficiency says it has found a $15 million contract at the Department of Veterans Affairs. DOGE says the Veterans Affairs Department has canceled the contract, which was for salary data and analysis, and replaced it with one that costs the agency far less. The U.S. and Iran are reportedly set to start the second round of nuclear talks this Saturday. This is Houthi terrorists say the U.S. attacked them late last night, killing seven people. And authorities say multiple French prisons were attacked overnight. It comes amid France's effort to crack down on cocaine trafficking. All of that and more after this break. I'm Stephanie Cox, and this is World Watch. The U.S. and Iran are reportedly set to start the second round of nuclear talks this Saturday. The Islamic Republic says the second meeting will take place in Oman again. Iran's Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei announced a second round of talks today. He says Iran is neither overly optimistic nor pessimistic regarding the talks with the U.S. Western powers accuse Tehran of seeking nuclear weapons. Iran says its program is for civilian purposes only. But both sides described the first talks in Oman as positive and have agreed to meet again on Saturday. This comes as the Houthis in Yemen say the U.S. attacked them late last night. Seven people reportedly died in the attack on the Iran-backed terrorist group. American officials have described the month-long campaign against the Houthis as a means to pressure Iran into the negotiations. Now to the war in Ukraine. NATO Secretary General Mark Rutte and Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky visited wounded soldiers in a hospital today in Odessa. Rutte's visit was a show of solidarity with Kyiv. It follows a Russian missile strike on the city of Sumy that killed 35 and wounded more than 100. The trip took place as the United States seeks to broker a ceasefire between Russia and Ukraine. Authorities say multiple French prisons were attacked overnight in response to government efforts to clamp down on drug trafficking. Officials say they're fighting what they call a tsunami of cocaine entering the country. Unknown assailants fired automatic weapons at the prison in the southern city of Toulon. Vehicles were burned outside other facilities across the country, and staff were threatened. It was not immediately clear who were the perpetrators and whether the attacks were coordinated. The French Anti-Terrorism Prosecutor's Office is leading the investigation into these attacks. And over to Bolivia, where the police there seized 2.5 metric tons of cocaine worth some $7 million in drug busts that took place between April 5th and 9th. Officials say the authorities had apprehended nearly 2,400 packets containing substances, four firearms, and arrested three Colombian nationals. Europe could impose retaliatory tariffs on hundreds of American goods. That's if trade negotiations with the United States aren't successful. The list of more than 400 products subject to additional duties of 25% was published yesterday. It includes American toilet paper, eye makeup, cigars and tobacco, and men's and women's clothing. The EU measures were to begin today in response to a 25% U.S. tariff on all imports of steel and aluminum. However, the bloc of 27 countries suspended its countermeasures until July 14th after the U.S. delayed its reciprocal tariffs by 90 days. And the U.S. envoy to Hungary warned the country about bringing in Chinese investment. The U.S. Embassy's charge d'affaires, Robert Palladino, spoke in the capital, Budapest. He said China poses a strategic challenge to the U.S. and its allies, and that vigilance and unity are needed. In recent years, Hungary has attracted 44% of all Chinese investment in Europe in recent years. It puts Hungary out of sync with the direction the U.S. is taking. Palladino said the U.S. isn't trying to lecture or micromanage Hungary, but that the China issue isn't about choosing sides, but about preserving the future of Hungary. According to a Swedish report released today, authorities did not find any evidence that a Chinese flagged ship in the Baltic Sea intentionally damaged two undersea cables last year. The Swedish Accident Investigation Board's report says investigators only had access to limited information and therefore were not able to figure out with certainty whether the data cables were damaged in Swedish waters intentionally or not. Chinese authorities led the investigation, with Sweden taking part as an observer. Swedish prosecutors can continue their own investigation separately. And big shifts happening in tech. NVIDIA will make AI supercomputers in the U.S. This is a first for the company. And President Trump is exempting phones and computers from reciprocal tariffs, but says he'll put tariffs on semiconductors soon. Why is he doing that, and when can we expect NVIDIA to ramp up production of these supercomputers? Our data reporter, Kevin Hogan, has the details.
Well, let's look into that. So this is a map of the United States. Made in the USA is what President Trump wants and what he's hoping for with these tariffs. NVIDIA is working with TSMC, the Taiwan company, as well as Foxconn and so others, to create these Blackwell chips. These are GPUs, graphics processors, that train AI. So they're doing that in Phoenix. And then in Dallas and Houston, that's where they're going to make these AI supercomputers. This is very high-tech stuff. I mean, this is 200 billion transistors, and there's Blackwell chips and so on. Again, this is not being made overseas. This being made right here could be because of those tariffs that they would have to pay if they weren't making it on American soil. And that mass production, they say, is going to start within about a year, or it could be up to 15 months, right? So in that time frame, that's when you can see these chips and AI computers really starting to be churned out. Okay, so now you talked about the electronics that are not going to have those tariffs. This is cell phones, you know, think iPhone, right? A lot of that stuff is made in China. So Tim Cook, the CEO of Apple, and iPhone lovers, you can rejoice because those product prices are not going to probably go up quite as much as we thought, and we're going to get into that. So this is all according to the U.S. Customs and Border Protection, the list they put out of those 20 electronics, right? And this ranges from everything. These are LCD screens, those flat screens, software, you know, routers, all this, hard disks, even, you know, your storage devices, all that coming from, you know, even from solar panels to laptops, as we mentioned, and so on. These are the 20 electronics that are not going to be hit with those specific types of tariffs. You might ask, well, why is it? But first, you know, Apple stock took a huge drop, and that was on what President Trump calls Liberation Day. You could probably guess that's right here, right? So April 2nd, that's when Trump put all those reciprocal tariffs on. What happened right after that? Immediately, that's $600 billion that Apple's market capitalization was just vanished in just a few days, right? It was able to recoup that. So again, its stock price went from about $220 down to, let's say, $180, and then it's come up back past $200. Now, it's possible that with a little bit more of this, you know, tariff, you know, hold off on this tariffs for a little while, investors could look on that, and maybe it'll recoup a little bit more of that. But again, yes, why is President Trump making these products, a lot of them, again, made in China, exempt? Well, it's probably to give these companies a little bit more time to reinvest in the United States. And here's what the deputy press secretary has told CNBC. We're going to take a look at that. At the direction of the president, these companies are hustling to onshore their manufacturing in the United States as soon as possible. So that's the motivation behind it. Again, these smartphones tariffs, they could show up at later time, but it's just so that these companies have a little bit more time to reinvest in the United States, as President Trump might hope. Because again, this is Apple's production in China, you know, from 0 to 100%. Their total overall production capacity is 80% in China. And then their iPhones, I mean, they make 90% of them all over there. And then Macs, more than half. iPads, talking 80%. So they make a lot of their products in China. And if they were to make them in the United States, they could bypass those tariffs. Now, they have other options. They could build it in, say, Vietnam. That's a place where they make a lot of their wearables, like the iPhone, or pardon me, the iWatch and so forth. So they could either bypass all of it by going to the United States or other countries. Now, you might remember back in 2023, the Tim Cook, the CEO, said that 95% of all of their products are made in China. So again, this is Evercore ISI data. It's a little bit of discrepancy with what Tim Cook said. The point is, Apple makes a lot of its products in China. That said, we now understand that what we reported before at the time was true, that the iPhone products, this 16 Pro Max 265 gigabytes, which is made in China, was going to jump up over 50% to $1,800 or so. But that is not going to happen because these products are exempt from those tariffs. So it's still going to hover about $1,100. Very expensive, but that's a high-end model. And now the ones from India, same problem. You know, same situation here. It's not going to go up, you know, 12%. It's still going to hover at about 1,000. But again, that's still very, very expensive. But you're talking about high-tech products, right? So that's a summary of what's happening with these tariffs at President Trump's direction. Back to you.
The CEO of Advanced Micro Devices said today they're ready to start chip production at a Taiwanese chipmaker's plant in Arizona. The CEO, Lisa Su, said they'll make more AI servers in the U.S. Speaking at a news conference in Taiwan, Su acknowledged the dynamic situation in the overall supply chain, but she added AMD is lucky to have broad and deep partnerships to help counter any issues.
When you think about the importance of the supply chain, we need to have a supply chain in all places. So certainly Taiwan is very important to us from a supply chain. And also in the United States, we just completed our acquisition of ZT Systems, which is a leading supply chain AI server capability in the United States. So yes, we are also expanding our U.S. capability.
AMD, one of the largest providers of personal computer chips, relies mostly on TSMC, the world's largest contract chip maker in Taiwan, to make its chips. President Trump said on Sunday that he would be announcing the tariff rate on imported semiconductors this week. He said there would be flexibility with some companies in the sector. And tennis icon John McEnroe, with 7 Grand Slam singles titles and a rare number one ranking in both singles and doubles, started his legendary career at Stanford. What shaped this fiery champion? Coach Dick Gold shares the untold story on Bay Area innovators.
How can I smuggle a terrorist into the United States? I don't have the power to return him.
An illegal immigrant deported back to his home country, El Salvador, is not coming back to the U.S. That's what Salvadoran President Nayib Bukele told President Trump at an Oval Office meeting. Bukele has become a strong Trump ally for taking in hundreds of alleged illegal criminals deported by the U.S. into his country's mega prison.
And you are helping us out, and we appreciate it. Thanks.
Bukele is known for cracking down on gangs and drastically lowering crime in his home country. He says to Trump,
"We have to imprison them so you can liberate 350 million Americans that are asking for the end of crime."
Bukele's indication that he's not sending back Kilmar Abrego-Garcia comes as the Trump administration has been defending the man's deportation in courts and in public. The U.S. government deported Garcia back to El Salvador despite a court order saying he might be subject to harm there. While his U.S. citizen wife says he's not a gang member, White House officials say he is, and that a Supreme Court order to facilitate his return does not mean that they must get him back.
Stating clearly that neither Secretary of State nor the President could be compelled by anybody to forcibly retrieve a citizen of El Salvador from El Salvador, who again is a member of MS-13, which, as I'm sure you understand, rapes little girls, murders women, murders children.
And now President Trump eyeing to send more illegal criminals to El Salvador.
As many as possible.
And potentially even criminals who are U.S. citizens.
They're as bad as anybody that comes in. We have bad ones too.
And I'm all for it.
Meanwhile, on tariffs, President Trump on Monday signaled that he might give exemptions to car parts.
I don't change my mind, but I'm flexible. We lost with China over the Biden years trillions of dollars on trade. Trillions of dollars. And he let them fleece us. And we can't do that anymore.
Reporting from the White House, Iris Tao, NTD News.
Still to come, tennis icon John McEnroe with 7 Grand Slam single titles and a rare number one ranking in both singles and doubles started his legendary career at Stanford. What shaped this fiery champion? Coach Dick Gold shares the untold story on Bay Area Innovators right after this break. An illegal immigrant was convicted yesterday in the 2023 slaying of a Maryland woman. Rachel Morin was attacked while exercising on a popular hiking trail northeast of Baltimore. 24-year-old Victor Martinez Hernandez was found guilty of murder and rape, among other offenses. The illegal immigrant allegedly killed another woman in his home country of El Salvador. Authorities also linked him to a 2023 home invasion in Los Angeles. The act of violence became a political flashpoint during the 2024 presidential election campaign as President Trump called for increased border security and deportation of illegal immigrants. Trump posted on social media about the case last night, blaming the Biden administration for failing to properly secure the border. What do Americans think of President Trump's efforts to send alleged illegal immigrant gang members to an El Salvadorian prison? NTD's Sam Wong was out on the National Mall in D.C. to hear from them.
I think if they have direct ties to those organizations or those criminal organizations, then yeah, they should go back.
Should they send them back to their own countries? Maybe not like a prison where they could be in danger, and it's just not right.
Certainly if there are criminals, let's have some due process. Let's show that these people are criminals and before we extricate them from the country.
For example, if you don't carry your papers with you everywhere you go, you snag me, I can't prove that I'm a citizen and I'm deported to El Salvador before I can say boo.
Yeah, if they have a criminal history and it's, you know, documented, they should not be here.
I don't care what country you're from. Families came from other countries, but they came in the right way.
They don't even take care of our own people. And they come over here and they get hotels, money, all kinds of benefits, and our veterans are sleeping on the streets.
What do you guys make of all the legal pushbacks against the Trump administration's deportations efforts in the past week?
I don't have nothing against it. He's the one we voted for. Should not have some kind of judge that's in a small town saying, hey, you can't not do that, when he's supposed to be over all of them.
The federal judges are there to abide by the Constitution and the foundational purpose of the Constitution. I think it's a good thing.
Well, I think it sounds like a good thing. We've got to put it on pause. We've got to make sure that we're following the law.
Well, I think the Trump administration is correct in that if you're here, if you cross into the country illegally, then you've committed a crime to some degree. There should be some sort of repercussions for that.
It's not a judge's responsibility. He wasn't elected. President of the United States was. We elected him, not the jurisdiction of the courts at a lower level. If they want to run for president, get their names on the ballot, run like everybody else.
Joining us now to discuss the El Salvadoran president's meeting with President Trump yesterday is Simon Hankinson, a senior research fellow at the Heritage Foundation's Border Security and Immigration Center and a former lawyer and State Department Foreign Service officer. Good to have you with us today. Nayib Bukele, he's been president of El Salvador since 2019, but many people may not know too much about him. What's your opinion of this figure that's suddenly on the international stage?
Well, he's a young guy, fairly young. He's done extraordinary things in a very short time, which has earned him a lot of praise in some corners and criticism in others. But there's absolutely no doubt that he was able to take a country which had one of the highest murder rates in the world, where people were not secure, you couldn't operate a business without being extorted, the gangs were running a riot through the country, and it now has a murder rate lower than that of most Western European countries. The gangs are under control. The streets are safe and people can live and work as they want to. So he's achieved a lot in terms of law and order in a very short time. at some cost, because, of course, there are a large number of young men who are imprisoned, who are allegedly members of gangs who are terrorizing the country.
Some have described him as a dictator. What's your take on that?
Well, as I say, he's going to get criticism from people who don't like what he's doing. There are always people who would rather have, you know, much higher crime and lower civil security, if that's what it takes in order to have not one single person, you know, have one right abused. But I think the people of El Salvador made their choice in electing him to take control of the country, to bring back law and order. And as far as I'm aware, he was duly elected and is the president of a democratic country.
All right. We heard it earlier. Bukele says he wants to help the U.S. defeat terrorism and crime. What do you think are his greater goals here?
Well, I hope all countries in our region want good relations with the United States. We have a large population of Salvadoran immigrants and U.S. citizens of Salvadoran descent, like we do Guatemalans, Mexicans, Nicaraguans, etc. And our trade with Central American countries is very high. It's usually a higher percentage of their trade than it is of ours, of course. So from a security point of view, we have many of the same concerns. I would think that Bukele's priority here is to maintain good relationships with the Trump administration. I don't think his you know, personal relationship was very close to President Biden, but of course, under the Biden administration, they wanted to maintain good relationships as well.
Yeah, let's dig into the relationship between Trump and Bukele a little more. That has been also in the spotlight. Yesterday's meeting showing some familiarity between them. Politico saying that President Trump deferred to Bukele and that it's a legal play. How do you see the dynamic between the two leaders?
Well, I would put it this way, that they have some things in common. You know, they're both, you know, charmers. They're both people who appeal to the masses, to parts of their countries that had previously been ignored, not to the elites necessarily. So they have that in common. And I think the kinds of people that like Trump tend to be the kinds of people that like Bukele and vice versa. And obviously they're cooperating very closely on the issue of Trump's deportation of people who are here in this country illegally, starting with the most dangerous, with the gang members and criminals. Some of whom President Bukele has offered to house in his detention center for gang members and other high-risk prisoners at some expense to the United States.
So digging into this from a legal perspective, a border security perspective, and a messaging perspective, did yesterday's meeting shift the dial?
I don't think it did. I think the agreement still stands, where the Trump administration is able to deport some violent gang members who are who have removal orders or who are being deported under the Alien Enemies Act to El Salvador. It's a third country where they will be detained outside of the United States, so that they're no risk to our people. There's this one case that's getting a lot of news coverage, the Abrego Garcia case, and I don't think that this particular meeting changed any of the legal, you know, machinery working in the background on that particular case. I did see that the President Bukele had said that you know, he wasn't inclined to send one of his citizens, a Salvadoran, to the United States for any particular reason, and he didn't want to release him in El Salvador as he considered him a threat to public safety there.
Now, Trump told reporters Monday he would also like to send violent homegrown criminals to El Salvador. What will you be watching for next in the Trump administration's efforts to address crime, terrorism, and illegal immigration?
Well, there's three very, very different things, right? We've got crime, we've got terrorism, we've got illegal immigration. I've been following illegal immigration and terrorism as far as those two coincide. The domestic crime issue is a completely different thing. Most domestic crime is handled at the state and local level. We've got rogue prosecutors in many of our big cities who just don't prosecute people for committing crimes, and the people in those cities like New York and Chicago and Los Angeles and so on have had enough. I certainly think the Trump administration supports prosecutors who do their best to maintain public safety, to prosecute and lock up recidivist criminals. So you can expect to see that support continue throughout the Trump administration.
All right. Thank you so much for your time today, Simon Hankinson. Good to see you and speak with you as always.
Happy to be with you.
tennis legend John McEnroe, famed for his 7 Grand Slam singles titles and holding the number one ranking in both singles and doubles simultaneously, once honed his skills at Stanford. His coach, Dick Gold, recently joined NTD's Bay Area Innovators to reveal McEnroe's unique path to greatness. Let's take a listen.
Our number one student, this legendary player, is John McEnroe. He was there for a year at Stanford, which is actually pretty long because I think he was really ranked number 21 in the world. I'm not sure what he was ranked.
Yeah, actually, John had gotten to the semifinals of Wimbledon.
Before he even...
Yeah, when he was in high school, they had a really good pro circuit starting out in the New York area, New England area. And so he'd take time out of high school and play some of the events there, Arthur Ashe, Stan Smith. Players like that, good players.
Those are legendary players.
Yeah, and he'd do really well. And he was in Junior Wimbledon representing the United States, which starts the second week of the main draw. And he won his qualifying matches, and then he kept winning, and he was still in it the second week when the junior event started. So he never could play a junior event representing the United States. He had to keep going. Wow. And he went all the way to the semifinals.
So what was he like, and what was it like coaching him during that period?
Well, first of all, you'd love the guy. He's really, I think he's probably one of the most loyal guys I've ever had. I look back at some of the things he did. We asked him to come back and speak to our annual speaker for our nonprofit for a underserved youth featuring education and tennis. He came back and gave an incredible performance and talk, and that was probably our best money-raising event ever. I think it netted over $700,000 in one evening with no auction, no nothing, just by the energy he created by being there. And at the end, instead of taking his speaker's fee of $10,000, whatever it was, he just signed the check back to East Palo Alto Tennis and Tutoring. That's the kind of guy he was.
I mean, it's really interesting how sometimes the image on the court, where he seems like a lot of emotion, sometimes he gets upset at umpires, you know, mostly. And what you may see in real life, they may be pretty different
pictures. There's two sides, always. Mm-hmm. I must say, when he played for me at college, mm-hmm. we didn't have umpires in most matches, and he had no problem. And when we did, he was pretty darn good. I never had any occasion to question him. But you could see as the year went on how the pressure was mounting. He really wanted to win. He is representing Stanford, but it's his to win or lose. For all the season, he's worked so hard for this thing. In good faith for all he's done for the team and the program, I cannot pull him out. And so I let him continue to play, and he was not a great citizen. In 14 days, counting the individual tournament, he played in 8 days, I guess he played 14 matches.
Wow.
He was just exhausted by the last day of the match in the finals. And I was so happy for him when he won that. And he was totally exhausted and spent.
So next, I want to ask you about your book. And I think the way this book came about, and please correct me if I'm wrong, is we had this executive, right, from the tech world. He asked you, how do you win so much and for so long? It was the CEO at Maxim, Jack Gifford, I believe, right?
Yes, it was.
And he asked you that, and then I think you gave a simple answer. He says, well, I get the best players, right?
That's exactly right. And Jack and I have been friends for a long time. And one day, just out of the blue, he said, Dick, how do you win so much? How do you win so many championships? And this is about halfway through my coaching career, and I hadn't really thought about that at all. And I just said, well, Jack, I get the best players. And Jack is in the Hall of Fame at UCLA for baseball, a very competitive guy. And he said, no, I've been around too long. A lot of teams have great players and never win. And then he asked.
So he wasn't satisfied with the short answer.
That wouldn't do it. And then he asked, and how do you win for so long? But that really got me thinking, and I could not answer him another answer than that. I thought, well, you know, I have players, I bet they'd answer some questions for me. So let me make a list of questions. So I made about 20 questions up originally that I thought might be relevant to try to answer Jack's question a little better than I could do. And this was in 2018, I guess, when I sent this letter out. And I had 83% of them, 166 of the 200, respond. Printed them all, 1,000, 1,500 pages, something like 2,000 pages, something like that. And that's the first time I gave any thought to coming up with a book.
The very short answer to the question that Jack had was, you got the best players. And the long answer is the book.
What really surprised me, Steve, in the whole thing was that there was no one secret sauce. It just impressed upon me how important example was for any leader. You don't tell someone to do. You do it, you just do it. If I want my courts clean and I walk by a piece of paper, if I pick it up and put in a trash can. My players do the same thing. Culture was very important. Treating other people right, caring about people was important. These things really came across, and there were probably 20 or 30 key things people said. This was the most important thing to me. This was most important to me. This was most important to me. But they were different.
Yes.
And this really struck me as well.
You can watch the full episode on EpochTV.com. And before we wrap up, footage of some unusual trespassing, first in Louisville, Kentucky. Local police released body cam footage of an officer escorting a deer out of a YMCA building. The video shows the officer entering the building and the deer standing in the lobby. The officer placed his hand on the deer and gently guided it out of the front door. Police say they're getting more and more reports of deer entering the city. This could be the result of storms and flooding over the last week. And in Indiana, a wild turkey got inside the store and started causing a commotion. An employee called 911 to report the wild animal, telling dispatch the large bird was chasing people and knocking products off store shelves. Body cam footage worn by the officers who responded shows the turkey perched on a display near the pharmacy. The canine officer approached the turkey and grabbed it by the feet. He carried the bird safely outside and released it near a wooded area. All right, well, stay with us. We'll be broadcasting the White House press briefing right after this break.